I'm Pam, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pam. We love you, Pam. Lots and lots and lots. And a whole bunch of love.
That's the best welcome ever, I gotta tell you guys. I'm really grateful to be here this morning. You know, I just want to tell you real quick, I owe such a debt of gratitude to young people in AA. You know, when I first came here, I was 32 years old, and I'll just share real quick in that part of my story that my first sponsor was 19 and a member of your group. And she took me through the steps. She carried me everywhere. She went with you guys. It was an awesome, awesome experience. And I really believe today, if it hadn't been for that kind of fellowshipping and support, I might not be here today. So thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. So what it was like, what happened, what am I like now? You know what? I grew up on the East Coast, grew up in a great family. On the outside, everything looked terrific. We had a nice house. We were well-dressed, well-fed. We did lots of great things as a family, but we had a secret in our house. It was called alcoholism. And you know, when I was growing up, I didn't realize that it was alcoholism. I thought everybody drank the way that my family drank. I had my first drink when I was about 6 years old. My parents used to have these great holiday parties, and there would always be these big bowls of eggnog. And, you know, they'd be putting the alcohol in one bowl, and the other one was kind of where, the kids and people who didn't drink drank out of. And I watched the people, because, you know, I think as alcoholics and addicts, we're really observant of others and what's going on around us. And I noticed the people drinking out of that other bowl, all the adults, were having a lot more fun than we were. So I decided to go over there and taste the sample out of that bowl. And I can remember, like it was yesterday, what it felt like. It was that heat that went from my head to my toes, and I was taller and smarter, and that hole inside went away, and I felt okay in my skin for the first time in my life. 6 years old, and I didn't feel okay. I didn't feel like I belonged. And I chased that feeling until I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous at 32 years old. Not drinking every day, but trying to fill that hole up with other things. You know, one of the things I think is really important to mention in my story is that when I was growing up, my dad was drinking, but my sister and I were both drinking the same way he was, alcoholically. And my sister was my younger sister, and there were times in looking back in my recovery, I felt guilty about being the older sibling and doing drugs and drinking before she did. But you know, I didn't understand that this is a disease. It's a disease that centers in my mind. It tells me that this time will be different. I take that alcohol in my body. I've got that allergy. And you know how I react allergically? It's an abnormal reaction. I keep drinking more. I heard someone last night say we have a disease of more. There was never going to be enough alcohol for me. There was never going to be enough to drink. I was never going to be able to numb out enough in order to not feel what I was feeling. You know, I thought for a long time that the reason I was an alcoholic was because if you had my parents, you drink. If you lived in my family, boy, you drink, you know. If you live where I live, you drink. I really believed that for a long, long time. And you know, that fueled my drinking for many, many years. It wasn't because I had childhood abuse. It wasn't because my parents didn't treat me right. I have a disease. I had no idea the way that I thought, my perception was skewed. The way I thought about things, the way I saw the world and my place in it was skewed, and I didn't get that. I was just trying to numb out the intolerable pain that I felt in every fiber of my being. And I don't know if you guys can relate to that, but I feel like my hair hurt. Every part of me was in pain. And I didn't know what to do about it, and I didn't know how to describe it to anybody, explain what happened. And so over the course of years, I drank, I became a daily drinker. I became a daily driver drunk, whether it was my vehicle or somebody else's. I drove people around in blackouts. I started to use other substances to fuel my drinking. And you know, so many times I would tell myself it was okay because other people were doing it. But I'll tell you what, I was the first one at the party and the last one there. And I started doing things like I'd take you to the party and I'd leave you in the middle of nowhere and I couldn't care less. I couldn't care because I knew at that time I had to have alcohol in my body to function. I couldn't get up in the morning without knowing I was going to have a drink. I just didn't feel okay without something in my body. And I started to spend time with people that drank or used the way I did. I looked for lower companions until I became one. Somehow found my way to college. Don't know how that happened because I know my grades weren't there to support me. All I thought about going to college was now I can really drink the way I want to. So my parents sent me to a Catholic all-girls college with nuns and priests. I think they thought sending me there was going to be like, that's going to save her. That's going to straighten her out. And you know, I just found a way to drink with the people who drank. I found out that some of those nuns drank too. And what we would do is we would buy a bottle of alcohol or buy some wine, and we would go to their doors and we'd knock and we'd give them this bottle and they'd be thankful, and then we wouldn't see them the rest of the night, so we could drink the way we wanted to. I always sought out something outside of myself to feel better. And you know, by the time I got to my bottom, and I want to tell you guys, my bottom wasn't about DUIs. My bottom wasn't about my age. It wasn't about how much stuff I lost or didn't get. It was about inside. And page 52 of the big book talks so distinctly about what I felt. I was prey to misery and depression. I couldn't control my emotional nature. You know, my relationships were a mess. I was angry. I was depressed. I was suicidal. I don't think it's normal to wake up every day and wish that you would die. I didn't believe in God, but I was angry at this God people talked about that allowed me to wake up every morning. How could there be a God? And I felt this way my whole life. And so when I was coming close to that bottom where I didn't think I could live with alcohol and I couldn't live without it, I remember being at a friend's house. All right, he was my drug dealer, let's be honest. And I remember being at his house, and I mean, the people in this apartment, there was like this huge snake guarding the stash, and there were people in various degrees of being drunk, and I'm like in a three-ring circus, and I'm sitting in the middle of this thing in Ocean Beach, San Diego, and I'm thinking to myself, how the hell did a nice girl like me wind up here? You know? Having some moment of clarity saying, how did I get here? What happened to me? This wasn't the plan for my life. This isn't the way I saw things happening. I don't know what got me out of that room, because there were a lot of drugs and there was a lot of alcohol. But the next thing I know, I was on a payphone, because don't you know, I hadn't had a place to live in a long time, nor a phone that my family could reach me. I had nothing but the clothes on my back and two cats. And I got to that payphone and I called my sister, because I turned around and I realized, holy crap, she hasn't been drinking with me in a while. You know, did you ever do that? You look around, you realize people you used to spend time with are suddenly gone. I was so busy drinking and taking care of me, I didn't even notice she wasn't around anymore. So I call her on the phone and I said, you know what, I think I need to move from the outdoors to the indoors. And so she says, I'll get back to you. And I'm thinking, I don't have a phone. How's she going to call me? Somehow she got a hold of me again. She said, you can stay here for 30 days. Okay. I'm good at manipulating and selling myself. She's not going to kick me out after 30 days. It'll be fine. So I took me and my two cats and got on the bus and went over to her house. And I have to tell you the story of going over to her house and sitting in the living room. And I see these people there with these little blue books, smoking cigarettes four at a time, drinking coffee, and I'm thinking, whoa, cult, religious group, uh-oh. What has she got into, man? And so I made a point of going and getting as drunk and obliterated as I could every time I knew they were coming. And they were there a lot. And I remember that look. You know that look of people when they see us after we keep saying we're not going to keep doing this, we're not going to keep getting drunk, we're not going to keep doing the things we do? And they look at you with that look of, oh. And that was the look. It just made me want to drink more. It really did. But you know what? I'll tell you what happened was that day came, that day 30 came, and my stuff was packed and by the door. And she said, you got to go. What? She said, you got to go. I'm sorry. Now, she never once told me while I was living there I couldn't drink. Because if you're a real alcoholic and somebody says, don't drink, sure, I won't drink. That doesn't happen. She never asked me not to drink. She never asked me not to get drunk. Because see, she's a real alcoholic too. And she knew I couldn't do that. But she also knew something else. That she was sober and she had to tell me I had to go. And what I didn't know that day was she was turning me over to her higher power. And she was trusting that I'd find my bottom and I'd make some different decisions. And so once again, I became homeless. You know, I'd like to say that opportunity got me sober, but it didn't. because there was nothing in my life, whether it was family or friends or fear of being homeless or being assaulted or any of the other things that happened while I was out there that got me sober. It just made me feel more sorry for myself and full of self-pity, and that's the worst place for me to be, is in self-pity. And I don't know what happened one day. This woman had invited me to come and stay at her house, and I did. And I decided that I was going to take a whole bottle of pills. She had all these beautiful pills in this glass jar on the table, and I just decided to take a handful, and I was going to be done with it. And I wanted to walk down to the Ocean Beach Pier, and I knew it was going to be low tide, and I was going to be done. Because inside, I knew I couldn't keep doing this anymore. And by the time I got down to the pier, what I didn't realize was that those pills, some of them were sleeping pills. And so I was very tired by the time I got there, and I couldn't get myself over the railing as I was going to toss myself over the side. And, you know, thinking to myself, my gosh, I can't even commit suicide right. And as I slid down that railing, feeling full of guilt and shame, feeling that sense of demoralization, like most of us who have been in that place know, I blacked out. And I'll tell you guys, I don't know how much time went by, but after I came to, I remember clearly hearing someone say, you don't have to live this way anymore. And I found a daily reflections book next to me. And you know, I still didn't get sober. I believe that my higher power had been speaking to me my whole life. And then I had to go through every single drink, drug, painful, excruciating, embarrassing, humiliating experience in order to get here today. And I can look back today and be grateful for every single one of them. So when that suicide attempt was a failure, I decided to reach out to my family. And I should tell you that these are the people, like I said, I blame for everything that went wrong in my life. These are the last people I was going to call. These are the people I hadn't talked to in over a year, who didn't know where their child was, who had no confirmation whether I was dead or alive, and I didn't know but they had an intervention already in place. Because like the big book says, wait until somebody is really sick and suffering and willing, and I got the gift of desperation. There was no other way I was going to come in. And so I showed up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on July 31st, 1993. I just celebrated 22 years this past July. And I went to the Tempe Bloopers. And there were two women there, both named Jennifer, both blonde. And I wasn't thinking too clearly, and they gave me their phone numbers. And they said, call us. I said, okay. And I did. And I reached one of them, and we had this amazing conversation. And I got back to the meeting the next day because they told me I should come back. And I was so desperate and so afraid at that point of failing again, I did whatever they told me to do. I walked in their footsteps. And when I got to the meeting, I went up to the woman who was my age, and at the time I was 32, and she said, oh no, you didn't talk to me, you talked to her. And there was this young 19-year-old blonde woman, soft-spoken, but had that light in her eyes. You know that light where it says, my gosh, I found the solution. Life is good. And she took me under her wing. And we went through our steps the first time in 90 days. I'm a real alcoholic. If I don't get busy to find power, I'm going to drink, and for me to drink is to die. And she understood that. She didn't tell me, wait, do a step a month, do a step a year. We got busy. She put my name on the board to chair meetings. I got the cool job of making coffee. How many coffee makers do we have out there? Woo, yeah, coffee's the best gig of all. I got to meet everybody. I did service work because I was told that if I did this on a daily basis, I didn't have to live the way I was living anymore. And I got busy. And I grew to love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I spent my time with young people. We went to all these goofy dances, and we piled up 20 of us in a car with $5 worth of gas, and we got to wherever we got to, and you guys took me camping, and you showed me how to have fun in sobriety. Most of all, you gave me hope, and you made me feel I had value. See, that's what I lost a long time ago. is that belief that I have value. I want to jump ahead a little bit and share with you a little bit what it's like today. You know, I have the opportunity to sponsor other women. I have a sponsor who I talk to on a regular basis. I love the practice of prayer and meditation. When I went through the steps the first time, I had that God I was still angry with. It's kind of hard to not believe in God and be angry at the same time. It just didn't, you know, didn't make sense. But I needed to find a new higher power. And so I started out with GOD, Group of Drunks. And I hung with you guys tight. And I went to 3 or 4 meetings a day. And we went for coffee. And sometimes I had no money, but you took me with you. And I got all kinds of ideas about what life might be like by listening to you share your experience, strength, and hope. I made amends in recovery. Those were hard. They were hard amends. But they were important. They were important so I could clean my side of the street and get clear on what my part was in my life and where you started. The most important thing, I think, though, for me in recovery has been my relationship with a higher power. I'm going to tell this story. My husband doesn't want me to because he likes it, but it's mine. I guess it was probably a year or two ago we went to Ocean Beach, and I was looking for a long time for that meeting that I had gone to, that I had gotten the Daily Reflections book from, and they weren't on the pier anymore, and I didn't know where they'd gone. And so last year at 9 in the morning, I found out on a Sunday they met at this club in that part of Ocean Beach. And so we went to that meeting. 22 years later, and I got to thank them. There had been a meeting called Daily Reflections on the end of the pier. And somebody had taken the time to say what they did to me and give me some hope. They'd left me a Daily Reflections book, but they gave me their time and attention. And they showed me that people care. That was a cry fest, let me tell you, that meeting. I didn't know who had left that book, but it had been a seed that had been planted. I want anybody who's here today to know that no matter where you are in your recovery, whether you've got a day or you've got 20 years, if you're struggling, reach out. And if you see somebody struggling, ask them how they're doing and actually stay around to find out. You know, one of the things that's always been so powerful in this fellowship for me is that we step out of the way when somebody needs help. We see a person who's suffering or asking for help, we step up. I just want to say that I'm really grateful to be here today. I'm grateful for my morning meditation group that we've had since I got here, both on Saturday and this morning. Thank you so much for being part of that. And thank you guys for being part of my recovery. Don't give up before the miracle happens. And while relapse isn't part of recovery or one of the steps, it happens, but it's what you do after the relapse. Keep coming back. Keep reaching out. Trust that there's a higher power at work here, and it will love you until you can love yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Pam. Oh, and that was Pam from Phoenix. I forgot to say Pam W. from Phoenix. There we go. And for our last speaker of this conference, I'd like to welcome Rob W., also from Phoenix.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Patrick. Rob, alcoholic.
We love you, Rob. Lots and lots and lots.
I love that. It's like a Chili Peppers. I'm glad to be alive and sober. Thanks, Dan and Patrick and Julie and the Flagstaff Alano Club people for their activity in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a pretty sweet deal. I know they're active and they have a good group up there. I I'll get to the parts of Pam's story that were incorrect and need to be straightened out but when we get there. But I'm not from Phoenix. I was from Scottsdale, and I say South Scottsdale because it's a big difference between Arcadia High School and Coronado High School. Our parents worked hard, or they went to work, and the kids all knew each other, and we all knew each other's parents, and couldn't get into too much trouble. But I fell in love with alcohol what I thought was early until I heard some of your stories after coming to AA. But I always knew there was something. I was at my grandmother's house in Phoenix at Fifth Avenue and Indian School, and we were watching Beretta because I didn't get to watch that at home. So Beretta's an old school raunchy street cops and robbers show, and I couldn't really identify with the cops and the robbers, although I love that stuff. But there was one other character on the show that caught my eye at 13 years old, and that was a junkie shuffling down the street, and I knew I was exactly like him. I knew he and I were the same. And I don't know how I knew that. I mean, the only thing I can place is that I probably watched Blood on the Highway or Reefer Madness or something like that in sixth grade or something in school. But I don't know why I knew that, but I just knew that I was out of place and something was wrong and I needed a solution. And when I started seeing, when I was old enough to recognize it, I knew it was going to be a chemical solution. I knew that there's something in me. And when I started to drink, it was at a friend of mine. We were born on the same day in the same hospital bed. Our mothers were best friends. His dad was a folk music singer, kind of country western type, Arizona, all over Arizona, pretty well known, used to be really well known. They lived on the side of Mummy Mountain, and they went out for the night. We broke into his dad's liquor cabinet, poured a whole bunch of stuff together and drank it. And I felt good for about, 3.5 minutes before I puked on the bearskin rug, which is not good because that puke stains anything. But I couldn't wait to do it again. He didn't drink again until like he was a junior in high school. But, I couldn't wait to do it again. And I knew I'd figure it out eventually. In high school, it was all about the sports. And it was all about, I was one of those kids that in class, if there was a window and all this stuff going on over here, but there was a window, I would have been focused on what's out there. I never wanted to be indoors or inside where I was. I wanted to be on the basketball court, the baseball diamond, wherever. So I was just itching to go and do and just, I couldn't sit in my own. They would have probably drugged me up nowadays, given me a ton of Ritalin from the time I was like five. But when I was 4.5 years old, I was watching either the Democrats or the Republicans in the national conventions, and my aspiration in life was to become prisoner of the United Snakes. And I kind of had this twisted look at the world, from the time I was a kid. I was a week before the senior year began, and all the high school parties and the keggers and everything were just the way I drank. A week before the senior year began, we showed up at the high school and we're going to drive to Fountain Hills and play golf. And the bus was full of golf clubs and other kids. So I decided I'd take a car, and three of my buddies from grade school piled in, and we headed out west to go to Fountain Hills. I had never driven this way before, and we ended up coming up on a stop sign. They're like, run this stop sign. Ain't nobody around here. So I went through the stop sign at about 4 or 5 miles an hour, and the next stop sign, run this stop sign. Ain't nobody around here. So I went through it 6 or 7 miles an hour, and we get to the next stop sign, and we get T-boned. And the guy sitting behind me died. The guy sitting next to him had hip surgery, and the guy next to me had plastic surgery on his forehead. And I had already loved alcohol, and I'd already not thought, I had never had some sort of God or some sort of religion. From this point, my twisted personality, I put on a good face most of the time, but there was just something really wrong with society and life. Why would God leave me, take this guy back here, straight A student? Everybody in that car was a little wild, but we were not out of control, it just didn't make sense. The world was just a crazy frickin' place. It didn't make sense before the accident. It certainly didn't make sense afterwards. I showed up to high school with a frickin' broken collarbone and my arm in a sling, and there was no rhyme or reason why I should have been alive. And a week after, or a couple weeks after my accident, a couple other students were in planes on their way to Tucson for something. They were all student council members, and so they were the people I would not normally hang out with. But like my wife, who's a student council member also in Jersey, but they were on planes on the way to Tucson. They played chicken, and they crashed, and one of the students I had known from the time I was in kindergarten died. And so our senior year was, to me, was just a blur. It was just a crazy, freaking unusual. I graduated with 550, 600 students, and I can only tell you about half of them. And the other, and the half of them I could tell you about, of that, of them, most of them I'd gone to grade school with. So it was just, you know, after the accident, I went to the funeral. What happened was we had this accident, and I ended up in the, you know, the ambulance came and got us and put me and the kid that was next to me, and we get to the hospital, and I'm in this room, and my mom comes to tell me it's going to be all right, and I pushed her away, and I kind of shoved her across the frickin', you know, the outside the this little screened-in room, and a priest came in, and I heard his family walking by, and I knew his brother, his twin brother. I'd known his parents. I knew his family. When I heard him walking by, was right after the helicopter had landed, and he was OR, and it was just something that shook me. And so, you know, in school, it was not, since there was just so much craziness, it wasn't like I was a freaking a zebra around horses or anything weird. I knew I needed to get out of town. I needed to leave Scottsdale. It was entirely too pasty and controlled. It wasn't colorful enough. There wasn't a lot of nightlife. I needed to see the world. I wanted to get away, and I wanted to escape. And I wasn't ready for college because my grades weren't good enough. I didn't have a Catholic girls' school that they could send me to. But what ended up happening was I looked into the Marines, and they were a little too intense, and they watched them a little too closely. The Army, they kind of crawled around a little too much and stayed in one place too long. The Air Force was a little too clean, and the Coast Guard was a little too small. So I found the Navy because they moved around an awful lot, and they had the reputation for drinking a lot. And so I went in the Navy, and it was there that, I don't know if we have any other Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin fans in the room, but I love lyrics, song lyrics, and I think the crazier and the trippier, the more that they write that's out there, I loved it. And I found that my alcoholism was enhanced by the things that you do when you're in a South Carolina trailer park at 3 a.m. sitting around a freaking coffee table. I quit smoking Marlboro Lights because there's just my Marlboro Lights and a bunch of Marlboros around there. And there'd be a bong going around, there'd be a mirror going around, and there'd be a number 7 going around. And I always had to have the number 7. The bong I wasn't too big on yet, but because I didn't want to mellow. I wanted to go, you know, and so the mirror stuff was kind of cool. I liked that a lot. But we had these piss tests, and so I had to kind of watch what I got away with and did. But I spent 4 years in the service, did a lot of things that were illegal, a lot of places. If I was there longer than a week, I got arrested. Nothing crazy. If I got in trouble in the service, in the Navy, they just kind of slap you on the wrist and say, you know, try not to get you in trouble. That's going to get you kicked out, unless it's the piss test stuff. But almost all my friends on the ship got popped somehow, and I don't know why I escaped. I think I just I probably wasn't as deep as they were into it yet. That's where I learned to smoke a lot of pot. I drank a lot. I took a lot of acid. And I drank a lot, and it was the only time I felt cool with the world. It was what added color to life. It's what made the world okay. I did okay with sobriety because I was probably sober about 9 or 10 hours before I'd leave the ship and go out and get loaded. And you know, we were it's kind of funny. We were on drug operations in the middle of the 80s. You know, my ship was sold and run down. We couldn't go across the ocean. So we've been on these drug ops, and I've been down to the Bahamas like 12 or 13 times. And I would have, I'd take watch, you know, if I had to stay on the ship, I'd make sure I was on there from midnight to 4 a.m. And my buddies would go, and they'd bring the grocery bags back onto the ship after they'd been ashore, you know, in Belize and the Honduras. You know, the corn grows this high in the Honduras, and the pot grows this high. And we would be on our way to a rum factory. We'd all look over and holy crap, we know where we're going when we get back from this tour. So we were on drug operations. We brought a lot back, probably just to check the quality of it, as much as anything. But I spent 4 years in, and I got an honorable discharge and a good conduct medal. And I framed the good conduct medal, and I used it to cut a lot of lines on it and to do a lot of things. And I wanted the scratchier the frame, the better, because it was just a freaking joke. Life was still a joke. I had seen bad things happen to good people. I had seen bad things happen to bad people, I just knew that I was going to die at 28. I wasn't going to live long. I thought I was going to go out at 28 like Jim, Janice, and Jimmy, my heroes. Found out after I'd been sober a few years, they were 27 when they died. So, yeah, that wasn't on any of our history tests, but it should have been. Yeah, but I got out of the Navy, and they forced us to stay sober one day out of four, and for periods of time, like a week when we'd be out to sea, we had to stay sober. So it allowed me physically not to have the stuff I was doing really take me yet. So I got out, and I came back to Scottsdale, Arizona. I was glad to be back. I'd been all over the East Coast in France and Norway and Canada and the Bahamas, and I'd seen a lot of places. And then I realized that this pasty, controlled version of what I thought life was in Scottsdale was probably not too bad. Roads were paved. Power didn't go out. I'd fallen through a lot of screen doors and apartment complexes after doing things that were on little pins covered by glasses and just kind of a mess. Most of the apartments I'd ever stayed at long term had broken glass and beer cans piled up, and just it was good to get home for a while. And I got a job with a big company, and I was making decent money for a 22-year-old. I knew they were going to hire me straight out of the service, but it was still work hard and play hard. What ended up happening was that I drank every day, and I partied at night. What I thought was partying was to find the best environment for me to cut loose as much as I can without getting caught, without getting in trouble, where we didn't have to go too many places, and I still ended up with 3 DUIs by the time I was 26. And I'm not sober because of the DUIs. Most everybody I hung out with had DUIs, but the third one was going to be the felony, and I knew that. I found I was going to try to talk my way around it or figure. I looked up 3 best attorneys I could find on the New Times magazine on the back, and I went and talked to these attorneys, and they all said, "You're screwed. There's nothing you're going to be able to do about it." I even told them what I had learned in the service. When I got out. One of the things I picked up in the Navy was there's a slogan on the Budweiser can, and it says, "This is the famous Budweiser beer. We know of no other brand produced by any other brewer which costs so much to brew and age. Our exclusive Beechwood aging produces a taste, a smoothness, and a drinkability you'll find in no other beer at any price." And, so here I am, and these attorneys are asking me to try to. He said, "What happened?" And I'm like, "I don't know. You have the pink and yellow paperwork. We got to figure this out. I'm going to construct a lie that's going to fly in court, and then, but I can't tell you because I couldn't remember the circumstances between DUI number 2 and DUI number 3. But I had been doing a lot of pool chemicals. I call it that. It was a lot of meth at the time. I like to stay awake on the weekends and try to show up to work on Monday if possible. I was the type that would, we'd go to lunch at Dirty Drummer on a Friday afternoon and think it'd be a good idea to go to Mexico. So we'd pile in my car, my buddy's car, and we'd end up in Rocky Point. And by the time the weekend would end, it'd be Sunday night. I was writing JJ, JJ's Cantina, JJ, a hot check, and using his cell phone to call in sick for Monday morning because I knew I wasn't going to make it back. And it was just I called in sick from the Salt River Recreation payphone. It used to be out there where you get the tubes to go up the river. It was just my life was spinning out of control. I really thought I wasn't going to make it to 28, and I didn't really know that I didn't want to die by my own hand. I didn't want to die up against an oak tree, but I just knew that people like me, we don't live long, and we don't make it to. The idea of having a house and a wife or kids, just I couldn't picture it. I had no money to. I mean, I was scraping. If it wasn't for Burger King drive-thrus and 99-cent Whoppers, I don't know that I wouldn't have died of starvation or malnutrition because I just drank so much and did so many drugs. You know, by the time I was 26, I was on this spiral that was going down so fast I couldn't stop. I physically woke up every morning. My bed was soaking wet with sweat. My head would be spinning. Life's out of control. My teeth were clenched. I'd crawl to the shower, on a work day, let the hot water pour over me for 20 minutes, choke on the toothbrush and try not to puke, grab the least wrinkled pair of clothes I could find and make my way to work. And that was how I woke up every day for the last year of my drinking. I wanted to stop. I wanted to go home at night and open up the drawer where I'd been sticking all the yellow and pink paperwork and seeing what a mess I'd made of my life. You know, and every morning I'd get to work and I'd swear that tonight I'm not going to go out. Tonight I'm going to go home. I'm going to do laundry. I'm going to freaking clean up the place a little bit. I got to open up that drawer, you know. But by the time noon would roll around, the roach coach would come, and nobody's still been able to explain this phenomenon. An alcoholic who's hungover eats a greasy burrito and we feel better. I don't know why, but it just seems to work. And by noon, I'd start to feel a little bit better, and I would hate to miss a Van Halen concert because I had to go home and do laundry. You know, so I'd start calling the buddies that would start, you know, crawling out of their holes, seeing what's going on that night. And usually by 4:30 or 5 o'clock when I left work, if I was at work, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and I needed to have a drink just to get okay with the world, just to get okay with life, to get past, because while I'm working, it's a distraction and I'm all right. I can dive into work in the afternoon when the hangover's gone and I can excel. But when the work clock stops and I'm in my truck or wherever and I'm heading somewhere, I can't go home. I can't be alone by myself, man, because my life is just effed. And so I would stop by the bar and as I walked into the bar, she was yelling, "Norm," because it was, you know, era cheers. And she would put a double shot of Jack and Coke, a shot of tequila, and a Budweiser on the bar. And I'd sip the Budweiser, I'd do the shot of tequila, and I'd sip the Jack and Coke, and I could hold that down in that combination. And then after I started to feel okay, then I'd start to feel good. And then I would think, why do laundry at 7 or 8 o'clock? You can do laundry at 9 or 10 p.m., you know. You don't have to do it right now. And then, of course, 9 or 10 p.m. would roll around and screw laundry. Heck with it. I may not even go to work tomorrow, you know. We'd be off and running again. And that's the way I lived, you know. So the last night before I went away, I was at the bar. And my headquarters. And I held the Budweiser bottle up saying, Sonny loved this too. But I held the Budweiser bottle up saying, God, I'm going to miss you. How am I going to live without you for 6 months? You know, and I didn't know that was going to be my last drink. You know, but I knew I was going away to the DUI joint for 6 months, and I knew it wasn't a scary place. It wasn't like it was I was going to have to fight for 6 months in order to eat my lunch, you know. But what I was afraid of was how to stay sober and how to live, anywhere without any some sort of substance. So I ended up getting, the next morning I got sentenced and I got sent away and I went through the horseshoe and about a month before I had got locked up, we were on a Friday, we were drinking all day and we'd been smoking some stuff out of pipes and bathrooms, you know, and looking, peeking through the blinds, and it was midnight and we'd been doing this for about 12 or 14 hours and we decided it was a good idea to go see a midnight movie. So we raced to the Civic Center in Scottsdale to go see this midnight movie. We get there about 11:55 or something, and we get out of my... I always drove, so, you know, at this point, there's no... I know I'm going to prison for DUIs. What's the fourth, you know? Anyway, we get out of the car, and my used car salesman buddy, of course, my best friend, runs down, and he wants to get there first. And I thought, well, I'll just hang on to the ledge of the second floor parking garage, and I'll just drop and roll. Well, I forgot about the fact that we've been smoking Coke all day and drinking all day, and I lost my grip and I landed on my back, and I kind of woke up with him yelling at me, and we went into the movie, and you know, we looked at each other and said, why are we here? And so we left and, you know, went and passed out somewhere, and I woke up the next morning and I had three broken ribs, kind of a screwed up neck, and And that was a month before I got locked up. So when I went through the horseshoe, which is now called the Matrix, I haven't seen the Matrix yet, and I hope I never have to. But the horseshoe was no fun, so I imagine the Matrix is just as exciting. I went through there with a bad neck and broken ribs and everything, and I got locked up that way. And I knew something was over in my life. I didn't know what it was. I just knew something was done. And I really thought it was just my freedom. I didn't think I was not ready to give up yet, because alcohol and drugs were the only way I knew how to live. And so I ended up finally getting to a I ended up in Tucson after about a month of the main jail and all this Alhambra stuff. And I went to this meeting in this trailer, and it was a small meeting with about five people. They talked about unmanageability, and I don't know why they would talk about that crap. I mean, who's got that going on, you know? But I didn't hear much of anything else. And then we went to, we left the meeting, and we were in tents outside of one of the prisons in Tucson, and we were fenced in right next to it. And it was kind of nice. It was October, and it was a gorgeous sunset, and I was watching the sunset in Arizona, and all of a sudden the sun's setting, and I'm thinking about unmanageability, and then it hit the barbed wire, and I'm thinking about unmanageability, and I'm like, God, I wish that freaking barbed wire wasn't in the way of this gorgeous sunset. And it's going, the sun's going down, and then all of a sudden it hits this weight pile and the thing over the top of the weight pile. I'm like, do they really have to put the freaking weight pile right there right in front of the sunset? And it dawned on me, you know, as long as I'm running the show, I'm never going to have anything that's not got barbed wire between me and it, or a fence between me and it. And when I ended up in the Douglas, Arizona, Papago unit on the border, DUI yard, and if you know anything about Alcatraz, it was like Alcatraz was really cruel and unusual, because they could see, it was such a stark place, but they could see San Francisco over there. Well, Douglas, Arizona is a lot like Alcatraz, the prison there. It was an old hotel. And it had barbed wire around it, but it was right next to a McDonald's and across the street from a Burger King. And if you know anything about jail and prison food, it sucks bad. I mean, it's really horrible. And to smell those McDonald's French fries and the Burger King Whoppers and not be able to get it, it's worse than Alcatraz to me. But it was a work yard, and we'd go to meetings, and I was asking a bunch of questions, and I was like, this place isn't scary enough for me. Florence, we hit Florence on the way to the DUI place. There's no fear that's going to keep me from drinking. I'm going to drink no matter what. And finally I asked, I was enough of a pain in the ass in the meetings that somebody brought me a set of tapes, and these tapes changed my life. Somebody brought me a set of Joe and Charlie tapes. And I'm in the DUI prison, and Joe and Charlie have introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody in the meetings there had any tangible experience with AA. No H&I commitment in Douglas. And Joe and Charlie introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really grateful for them. I owe everything I am and everything in my life to Joe and Charlie. And I got out of there and went to the Valley Alano Club on 64th and Thomas. And I was 26 years old. I had a couple felonies and a really neurotic PO, no hope of not drinking. I had no hope of staying sober. I just knew that I needed to find... I thought if I could get to Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys would give me a cheat sheet. See, Joe and Charlie didn't talk about a cheat sheet, but I knew there'd be some slick people in these rooms that would have figured out how to get a social security number and a driver's license and a job with felonies, get over on the probation department. I already knew how to pass piss tests. I was pretty good at that stuff. So I figured that I just needed the other ideas, the Cliff Notes version of sobriety. And really, that's... what I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for. And from the time I was, you know, at 26, from the time I was about 16, somebody was always sitting across the table from me saying, this is what's wrong with you, because I never drank. I mean, I started off drinking and having a good time, and by the end of the night, I'd knock something over, or we'd be puking somewhere. Anyway, it was a mess. But from the time I was 16, somebody was always sitting across the table from me, and they said, this is what's wrong with you. You need to quit drinking. And their solution for that may have been, as I turned 18 and 19 and 20, their solution was either religion or anabuse or treatment or something that had no play in my life. And so I would just turn into a bobblehead, tell them what they wanted to hear, get the conversation over with as quickly as possible, and go my way, you know. Because if somebody tells an alcoholic not to drink, they may as well have been telling us not to breathe. It just doesn't fly. But here I am, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I figured you people would try to convince me that alcohol is evil and that alcohol and drugs are going to ruin my life. And I already kind of knew that, but I didn't want to hear it. It was still the only solution I'd ever known. The only thing that fixed that window of where I wanted to be and made the world okay was alcohol and drugs. And I came to you people and you quit, and not once did I hear, this is what you need to do. They started sharing with me what they did. And it was a language, there's an acceptance and a love in these rooms that just freaking hooked me from the beginning. I hung around with a lot of people, and karma was our only rule. You get my back, I'll get yours. We got to watch out because they're out there, you know. Some of our buddies were good at that. Some of our buddies were not so good at that. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people, I mean, the acceptance and the love in AA just freaking floored me. My first meeting was 10 p.m. on a Thursday night at the Valley Alano Club on 64th and Thomas. After I was there about a year and a half, we started jokingly called it the 1008. And I took a pencil and I reached over to 10:00:00, and I turned that last zero into a snowman. And so we kind of changed our format that way. And then a couple of smart guys came in and they got it registered as a 1008. And that, at the time, a night meeting at 10:08 in South Scottsdale, it wasn't really my home group, but it was one of the three or four meetings a day I would go to. I had a lot of energy, a lot of time. I worked. I got a job making $5.50 an hour, answering a 1-800 number at a hotel chain on 44th and Van Buren, right on the bus line. And my early sobriety was work, but go to a meeting before work, go to work, go to a meeting after work, and then find out what's going to happen. Where's the party? Who's playing? Where are they playing? Do I have enough money to get in? Is she going to be there? And can I smoke in their car if I go with them? So life was really difficult in early sobriety. I started chairing meetings at my home group. I joined this wave of Alcoholics Anonymous, of these people doing service work. And I was the only one under 35 or 40 in my home group, the 5:30 happy hour at the Valley Alano. There was one other lady who was there from Nova Scotia, Halifax. She was the mother type, and she was probably 60 when she got sober. Maybe 50, but when I'm 28 or 26, she was over 40. So there was nobody that was sober my age. So I wanted to go. You know, if they're going to a meeting, take me. I'm going with you, you know. That was my life. I wasn't really ready yet to give up the idea that I would go back to the party someday. A buddy of mine and I walked into a 7-Eleven and got a cup of coffee, and as we're leaving, this guy behind the bar said he used to be one of the biggest partiers in Scottsdale. And I said, "Hey Jeff, did you hear that shit?" I wasn't ready to give up on this yet, on the old life. What happened with me was I was a couple months sober, and it was 2 a.m. and I had one shoe on and I was going to go steal a bottle. AA wasn't getting me well enough, quickly enough. I wasn't getting things that I thought I needed. I wasn't getting complete relief. So I had one shoe on. I was going to go steal a bottle or knock on a couple doors on the way in to get to the grocery store before I stole the bottle, because I knew their lights were usually on at night and I know what they were doing. I had one shoe on, and I just remembered somehow you people spoke louder than my brain, way louder, because I was already past the point of no return. I was already gone. I was in relapse mode. I had already pictured the bottle, how I was going to get it out of there, popping the top off that thing once I got out of sight, and I knew it, and I was gone. It had control of me. I was in full obsession at that point. And I opened up the big book to the page in the book where it says the third step prayer, page 63. Because Joe and Charlie, I had a lot of page numbers and a lot of memorized things, like the Budweiser theme. And I opened up that page and I did that third step prayer. And I just remember taking the shoe off. And I went into the bedroom and I went to sleep. Since this is ASCII PA, I don't have to tell you that I'm going to sleep at 2:30 in the morning and getting up at noon to go to a meeting is out of the ordinary. It's freaking completely normal. But that's what happened. As I went to sleep and I got up the next day and I thought, holy crap, I have never, never not used, not drank at that point, ever. And I got on my bicycle and I was riding to the noon meeting, or I think it was the noon meeting, and I'm in Thomas Road heading down to 64th Street in Thomas to the meeting, and this guy, I'm on the right, I'm doing what I'm supposed to. We made eye contact and he was in the car, so I'm sure he saw me. He pulls out and hits me anyway, and I'm thinking, bastard up. I'm swearing. I got up off the bike. I kind of felt him lurching forward, so he didn't run me over completely, but he hit me, you know, and knocked me down. And I got up, and years before I gotten sober, I'd put my hand through a windshield, so I knew I could do that. I was going to walk over. I was going to bash in the passenger, the driver's side window. I was going to grab him and kick his ass. And as I was walking back to that car, I stopped in the middle of the street, and I just looked up, and I felt. It's not supposed to be this way anymore. I felt that between my, all of a sudden the rage was completely gone. I'm standing in the middle of Civic Center in Scotts and Thomas Road in Scottsdale, and I just had complete peace and relief, overwhelmingly. And, the rage was instantly taken away. And, all of a sudden I had tears in my eyes. I was just completely, like, I had never experienced anything like that before. And the guy came up and tried to hand me money, and I, of course, I didn't want his money. I'd been to enough meetings to know that money will screw up a spiritual experience pretty quickly. So I refused that, and it's a good thing I had this experience too, because there were four guys in the car. I wouldn't have gotten very far, but still, I would have to the bitter death, you know, right to my death. But at that point, so I ended up hobbling the bike to the Alano Club, and I was just so grateful, you know, And then this thing was happening in Flagstaff, and my home group was talking about going up there, and they had reserved a whole bunch of campsites at the Flagstaff Roundup, and this is 1993. I got sober in February of 93, February 28th, and so I have 22 years also. A little bit ahead of my wife. She just turned 22, so I have a few months more than she does. It's very important to know that there's... I mean, if you ask anybody with 90 days how important those 90 days are, well, it's freaking important, you know. I try to describe to her between February and July the spiritual influx that had happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. She doesn't buy it, but I'll keep trying. I ended up catching a bus. I'd asked for a couple rides from my home group to the Flagstaff Roundup in 93. And I told, well, maybe I can fit you in, whatever. And I'm not going to keep going and asking for help and not getting, you know. And I had a sponsor, and he wasn't sure he was going to go. And so finally I was feeling sorry for myself Thursday night, you know, poor me. And I talked to my mom, and she said, well, why don't you just take a bus ride up there, catch a bus up there? And I'm like, well, that's brilliant, you know. So I called Greyhound. She dropped me off at the bus station. I got on the bus, and it was a really cool hour and a half ride up there reading a big book. The bus driver let me off at the exit to the Coconino County Fairgrounds. I walked across the exit and got a ride into my campsite and my home group, and they took care of me that weekend. And I heard two of the best speakers I still have yet to ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. That weekend rocked my world. It changed everything I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous that happens between meetings, and it completely altered my life. I got moved in ways that I, you know, unless you experience one of these things in these conventions and you just get attached to this wave and you ride that perfect frickin' wave into shore, that feeling is so frickin' cool. And that's what happened to me that weekend. And I knew at the end of that weekend, we gambled at night. We told dirty jokes around campfires. I had never been around a campfire without doing this. You know, crunch, give me another one. You know, I was like, this hand just did this, you know. So it was like this weekend, I watched one of the girls in my home group go into two different tents. And I thought, all right, you know, woof. Yeah, we're not saints, but it kind of opened up a lot. I figured out, wow, these people are just normal. Really cool. They're grateful to be alive and sober, and we're not getting arrested, you know. And we had this, there was 2,000 people or whatever camping that weekend, and they rocked my world up. And I knew no longer had one foot in the idea that I would go back to the party. I couldn't swear I'd never drink again. I couldn't promise anything like that. I couldn't promise I'd never do drugs, but I just knew that no matter what happened, I was going to go to meetings. I owe a lot of my sobriety and debt of gratitude to the Flagstaff Roundup, and I understand they're coming up here. So I'm glad that Asking Pa was here this weekend and answered a lot of questions, because I, you know, change is not good sometimes. When something that saved my life, you know, I don't want it to alter or change. But I got back home, and my job, of course, progressed. I ended up getting on a Rocky Point Roundup committee because it was happening out of the Valley Alano Club. And I was not a very good student. I had never gone to college. I had not done anything for work that was really excelling, except for I kind of got some good gigs in the Navy. But what happened was planning an event in a committee that takes place in Rocky Point Roundup. Being on a committee changed. I learned what I can bring to the table. I mean, we work really well together when we want to. When we have a goal of throwing a party, we can really go to it and get it done. And it altered. It showed me. I got confidence. I got self-esteem. I got the ability to make a commitment and show up and do it. Between that and chairing meetings at my home group and making coffee, Alcoholics Anonymous has filled in the gaps of my life that made me see through that little window and reach things that I didn't know were capable of. And and I was 3 years sober when I chaired that roundup, and I walked behind the cantina. There was a cutout in the Playa Bonita Hotel, and I walked behind the cantina, and I saw the cantina's a bar, and I saw 75 people in a marathon meeting there, and I just broke down and freaking cried right there out of gratitude, just sheer grateful that I could be a part of something for a year that was so cool and so many people could have a good time. And it took place on the patio of this hotel. And, you know, we'd have Dr. Paul there. We'd have Danny T. We'd have the speakers would hang out on the patio. We had complete access to them for the whole weekend. And it was just a great event. And I loved it for the first 8 or 10 years it was there. I chaired the meeting the third year. I chaired the roundup the third year, the fourth year, and kind of, you know, was the outgoing chair the fifth year of it being down there. And I just loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed busy. And at 5 years sober, my job was, I was still working. I was working as a computer operator on the other side of town, west side, at night. And the big company, Motorola, called me up and asked me to come back to work. And I looked at the phone and said, "You want to hire me back?" And they said, "Yeah, Tuesday through Thursday, you're a pretty good employee." So I talked to my sponsor, I did the paperwork and left the results up to God. And, and I'd been talking to God all along, and my concept had grown a little bit. You know, I was never really a religious God. It was more of a sprinkling of Hindu and Buddhism and Native American beliefs and, a lot of that, and some of just the really cool energy that goes on and that I've seen in AA and other parts. And, but we left the results up to God. And I didn't think of God as a puppet master pulling strings, but you know what? If it's going to be, it's going to be fine. You know, and I got out of it. I just did the paperwork and left it up. And that Saturday morning, my group was playing softball against the North Scottsdale home group. And, I showed up to play softball a little early, and there was a guy that had 30 days, and he was sitting on the bench waiting for the game to begin. And I walked over, and he was at my home group, and I said, "Dale, how you doing? You got a sponsor, everything going all right?" For a couple minutes, I just checked in with Dale, made sure he was okay. And finally, I leaned over to the guy, reached out to the guy sitting next to Dale, and I said, "By the way, my name's Rob White," and I stuck out my hand. He had a ball cap on. He looked up, and he said, "I knew who you were from the moment you walked up." And he had been a former VP at the company who years before I had to have him sign off on some paperwork. And he had retired, but his best friend was the director over corporate security who had to approve my rehire. His very best friend, who he talked to almost daily, had to approve my rehire. But not only that, but this VP was Dale's older brother. And he was there to see what sober softball was like with his younger brother. You know, and so I got hired back by that company, which would not have happened. And I haven't seen that guy or Dale since then. You know, I'm not exactly anonymous in AA, but I know there's just no way I create that. There's just no way. There's a rhythm, like he had talked about Sunny last night, and Tara, and the speakers we've got this weekend have been great up until now. But there is a rhythm, and just getting on this wave and just doing what we do, no matter what my head tells me, there's answers that take place over time. I get to learn about life in hindsight. You know, it's 2020 from yesterday and before, if I can remember it, with help. But I live this moment and make plans for the tonight, tomorrow, and what's going on. But I only learn about life in hindsight, and I can guarantee you, if you're new, you quit drinking and quit doing drugs and hang on with us and stick with us, your life will unfold. You'll be able to see the hand of God in your life. I don't know anybody that stayed sober a couple years that hasn't had a spiritual experience. I would tell you when I got run over and on the street and I was standing there, that was pretty cool, but it wasn't the type of spiritual experience. It wasn't a burning bush. It wasn't a white light. I mean, Bill Wilson had a white light fill the room. Now, I know what a white light looks like. I've not a lot of red and yellow and blue lights behind you look like too, but that wasn't a white light. And that was years before I realized that was as strong a spiritual experience as I could ever have. But so I've been back to work. This company hired me back. When I was 3 years sober, this girl shows up at my home group, and she had just moved over from Bloopers, and I loved her from the minute I met her. She had an energy and really cool, and but she was in a relationship, so I figured I just, you know, she had made a couple good friends who were also good friends of mine, and they knew how I felt about her, and they knew how she felt about me. But I think this is the first time in the recorded history of mankind that two women have ever kept something like that to themselves and not shared it. But for 2 years, she was in this relationship that wasn't going anywhere, and it finally ended, and one of the girls told me it had ended. And so after it ended, a week later, we went out to dinner at Denny's, where everybody goes or used to. And everybody went home, and she and I stayed and talked all night long, and I was pouring coffee because the waitresses were tired, like Ryan. Or Jake, I was pouring coffee all night, and we talked, and then a couple days later I asked her to go out with me, and so I couldn't stop thinking about her, so we went out and we danced the Rage Against the Machine, you know, F you, I won't do what you tell me, over and over with the microphone, and he jumped down on the stage with us, from the stage, and it was just kind of cool. We went back to her place because she had a better house, and you know, we've been together ever since. So when we talk about dating, I know that AA is more like, if a guy and a girl go out for coffee, and they can, they might go back to one of the other's places. Usually it's the one that has the better place, but or the car, or that has to get up early to go to work the next day. So there's some factors. But we've been, you know, at 5 years sober, we got together, and we've been together ever since. And that's about when I got that job. And that job, I ended up going back to school and getting a degree. I went to University of Phoenix, U of F. It's like the perfect school for alcoholics, because we can make a commitment, we can show up, and we can produce something. That's all we have to do. We have to produce something. And it's like, I mean, after about 3 years, they handed me a degree. It was pretty cool. But I know a lot more about myself in life. And, you know, and I've always been a big fan of our fellowship and our history. I've always been a big fan of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and how cool this wave is that we get to ride. You know, and I've been to conventions and roundups, and I don't ever want to stop going to where the parties are. If I ever quit getting the love and feeling that and what's going on in these rooms, and last night absolutely blew me away. I couldn't go to sleep. It was pretty incredible. I went to the 1995 ASCII pod, and it had a little stick figure with a halo over its head, and it says, "We are not saints." And I've kept the T-shirt in the closet, and it's got tattered collars, and I can't really wear it, but I don't want to let go of it, because it's you know, I've got some 1997, 98 Flagstaff garb, and it's those things are as important to me as, you know, my big book is, and I've been a big fan of our literature, and you know, and I'm grateful to know that my first 2 years of sobriety, I was big on the lyrics. There's a line in A Vision for You which sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really grateful for the speakers pulling stuff out that's meant something to them. That line in A Vision for You is, it says, "As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down, ever becoming blacker. It thickened and becoming blacker, and we sought out sordid places and playgrounds and playmates." And, you know, I woke up every day facing those hideous four horsemen. And I know now that if I have a problem in life, it's between my ears. And if I have a solution in life, it's usually with my heart connected with your heart. And I'm really grateful. I love AA. Not only did I, you know, because I got sober at 26. He knew they were 27 when they died. When I turned 30 years old and I was 3 years sober, my birthday, I just kind of sat there and had tears rolling down my cheeks, because I never thought I'd make it to 30. You know, when I turned 40, I had, you know, goosebumps, because I never thought I'd make it to 40. You know, and in a little while, I'll probably end up being 50. And, you know, I love this deal so much. And I just want to thank you guys. And I need you as much today as I did when I was new. And that learning experience of where that defeat comes from in that first step, it can take years for some of us. It can take multiple relapses, you know, but what, it has to happen deep down. That surrender has to happen from in here. Because if my surrender is intellectual, that's the depth that I'm gonna ask God for help. And I really want a heartfelt sobriety. I want to be connected with you guys in ways that I couldn't slice it, undice it, and get rid of it. I can't pull away from Alcoholics Anonymous without feeling like I'm missing something. You know, and it's like two twins on opposite coasts. One hurts his hand, the other feels it. Well, I know that God gives us that energy too. science can't figure out why a mom can pull a car off of her son or her baby, you know. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we see miracles like that all the time. And you know, if you're new, I hope you heard something this weekend. I hope you felt it, and I hope it hits you right between the eyes and into the depth of your heart and your soul, you know. And I'm just really glad to be here. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you, guys.